Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C., and we are descending deeper and deeper into the greatest world economic and financial depression of all time. And this is now a month-by-month process. We're recording the program here on Friday, February 6th. And as far as the unemployment statistics, they are about as grim as can be. During the month of January, according to official statistics that always underestimate these problems, the United States economy lost a total of 600,000 jobs of all sorts. 600,000 jobs lost. Now, that means that the descent into the depression is accelerating. In November and December, it had been 500,000 jobs lost per month. Now it is 600,000 jobs per month. This is the worst unemployment level since 1974. That is to say, the job loss, 600,000 jobs in 1 month. In order to find anything comparable, you've got to go back to 1974, which was, of course, the David Rockefeller Kissinger oil hoax, the first fake oil crisis, you'll remember, hoaxed up, ginned up, in order to absorb the dollar overhang and stabilize the wrecked post-Bretton Woods dollar as the world reserve currency. So that was the last time you lost 600,000 jobs. The unemployment rate itself, 7.6%, is the worst since September 1992, which was the economic recession at that point, caused by Mad Dog Bush the Elder. Mad Dog Bush the Elder, of course, his economic stewardship was absolutely devastating, and that is the main thing that got him kicked out of office. You remember, he wanted to campaign on his bloody-handed first Gulf War, but he couldn't do that because the economic news was so awful that nobody would listen to him when he wanted to talk about Iraq. That was the November 1972 campaign. So 7.6% unemployment. Now, when they say 7.6% unemployment, this really means something in the area of 15 to 20%. Everybody knows how the Labor Department works, how the state labor departments work. Once you give up in despair, you disappear. So you're now dealing with unemployment between 15 and 20%. Now, at the time Roosevelt came into office at the depth of the Depression, March 1933, it's about 25%, and probably those statistics are also understated. So you get the idea, though. If we're now approaching 20% unemployment and, say, the depths of the Depression were 30%, we are now on our way towards the depths of that old Depression. But remember, this Depression is worse. This Depression is far worse. What makes it worse? Try 1.5 quadrillion of bankrupt toxic derivatives. That's the burden on the world economy that nobody even dreamed of in 1933. Nobody dreamed that you'd have $1.5 trillion of derivatives, credit default swaps, structured investment vehicles, mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, mortgage rate, auction rate securities, you know the drill, all of those different kinds of paper based on paper, essentially options. This is a world derivatives depression, and that, of course, is why it cannot be bailed out unless you put the main banks through the shredder. They've got to go into bankruptcy liquidation and have all of those derivatives wiped off their books. Interestingly, there's some Robert Shiller of Yale comes forward this week in Newsweek. I've still got to get this article, but there's an article in Newsweek this week that derivatives are actually the way out of the depression, argues Robert Shiller of Yale. I wonder if he's been at the tables down at Maury's or the tables over at Skull and Bones to believe all that. On the unemployment front still, we lost 207,000 factory jobs, productive jobs. See, there's a difference. A stock salesman is not productive. An assembly line worker is. And when you start losing 207,000 factory jobs in a month, this is the thing that drives the depression lower and lower. Because remember, the entire society, sooner or later, has got to live and exist and eat and function and drive and live and wear on the basis of the output of those factories. In other words, the absolute surplus of the industrial and agricultural economy is the thing that allows civilization to go on. And all of those other jobs represent claims on the surplus, but they don't add to the surplus. The factory job adds to the surplus. So this is the worst decline in factory jobs since October of 1982, meaning the Volcker 22% prime rate depression of those years. That was the long, long hangover of Jimmy Carter, made worse by Ronald Reagan, the great communicator. There was an example of left-wingers and right-wingers teaming up to make a depression really devastating. And that was a depression that went on from 1979 until 1983-84. So these are now the statistics. The worst month since 1974, the worst rate since 1992, and, of course, the work week remains at an all-time record low, 33.3 hours. That's a record low that had already been reached in December. That is where it stayed. So this is, on the whole, a disastrous report. Now, making it even worse, and we're going to try to see if we can research this story. Everybody is now reporting that the state unemployment bureaus are overwhelmed by the people coming in claiming their benefits. And that means their money, the money they paid in, their economic rights, the fruits of mass struggle and political action going back to the Social Security Act of 1935. That's how you got unemployment benefits in the first place. New Deal, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and lots of labor struggles were the ingredients that made it possible. Those are your economic rights. And don't let some Austrian take them away, and don't let some Obamazoid take them away either. Fight anybody who wants to take away your economic rights. Now, the alarming news, and I'm trying to figure out which states are involved, but it's basically this. The Wall Street Journal this morning is reported to have a story that seven states are almost at the point of running out of unemployment insurance money in the state trust fund. Now, that means, you know, when you pay payroll tax, part of that, a small part, goes into this pot of money, which is the unemployment trust fund of each state. Again, Social Security Act, 1935, one of the absolute essential features of modern civilization. If you don't have this, you're basically living in a jungle where people can, you know, they'll be dying like flies. They'll be dropping left and right. So we now have seven states where the money is about to run out, and 11 states, I believe, that are not far behind. Now, just going through the individual articles, every individual state reports this as if it were their problem. As far as I can see, it's Minnesota, Tennessee, Georgia, Colorado, Missouri, and perhaps California that are in this position of having no money left in the unemployment insurance fund. This is an extremely serious matter. The other 11 states, as I say, I'll try to figure these out, and perhaps I can figure this out in the course of today's broadcast. But here's the idea. What's the precedent on that? It is 1934. This is where Roosevelt called in Harry Hopkins and said, we've got 18 million people who may starve to death. Do something. And thank God Harry Hopkins did. He was not an Austrian. He was an American. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. The fact that we have all of these states that are about to run out of unemployment insurance, and again, I think it's 7 states are at the point of running out and 11 more not far behind. Let's try to figure out which ones. But let's remember what this means. If you fall off the unemployment rolls, be it because your state has gone bankrupt, there's also the fact that you probably get 26 weeks plus 13 weeks at this point, maybe an extension beyond that in certain very high unemployment states. What happens then? Well, in the old days, it was local poor relief, right? The local dole. That was largely then replaced by general assistance welfare. But, of course, general assistance welfare was wiped out, for example, by Governor Engler, the reactionary Republican in Michigan, probably wiped out in, that was about 1991, 1992, that Engler, the Republican fat cat, wiped out general assistance welfare in the state of Michigan, probably one of the states where it's needed now. It's therefore not clear what happens to people if they fall off the unemployment rolls, because Bill Clinton, there's no way around it. Bill Clinton was the guy getting ready to run for president in 1996 who decided to placate and propitiate reactionary opinion by abolishing welfare as it was then known. So what happens now? You're essentially back to 1933, 1934, except in some ways worse. Now, let me stress what is required. This is going to now require federal emergency relief. Yes, federal emergency relief, as in FERA, Federal Emergency Relief Agency. Harry Hopkins created November, December 1933, going into 1934. This was a time when you had about 18 million people who had exhausted unemployment insurance. They had exhausted relief. And we have this interesting description here in one of the biographies of Harry Hopkins, how he was told to do all this. And at that point, he had $600 million. And what they did, this is actually a example of how government can act fast to save your life in the way that nobody else will do. The frantic activity by Harry Hopkins produced astonishing results. Hopkins originally wanted to say, let's employ 4 million people in the project. By November 23rd, he had started in early November of 1933, by November 23rd, 800,000 were on jobs created by CWA, another New Deal agency. 2 weeks later, 2 million were employed. And by mid-January of 1934, 4.25 million were employed. Now, that means 4.25 million jobs. Multiply that by 3 or 4, and then you'll get an idea. CWA and PWA teamed up. Construction, street and road repair, sewage and water works, building repair, construction, recreation projects, plus FERA. That's effective government action, and that's what we're going to need soon enough. Now, that's not what we're getting. Remember, Obama is not the New Deal. Obama is not Roosevelt. Obama is the anti-New Deal and the anti-Roosevelt. He makes payments to banks. He convoys money to Wall Street. He pays Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America. Remember, so far, nothing has been done to stop foreclosures on individual homes, to say nothing of farms, businesses, infrastructure companies, and all the rest. We need a blanket ban on all foreclosures of anything, except, of course, banks. Those are the ones that ought to be foreclosed on. The government ought to foreclose on them right away. So this is the situation we're now in. And in the middle of all this comes the question of this stimulus bill. It's thought to be on the verge of a vote in the Senate. Now, remember, the House of Representatives passed $820 billion worth of so-called stimulus. The Senate has increased this up to about $920 billion. Don't be frightened by these figures. These are now highly inflated. These are quasi-hyperinflationary dollars. And remember, the goal of economic policy right now cannot be paper in any form. You cannot be concerned about paper values of stocks, of bonds, and you don't even have to be that concerned about deficits, except in a very general way. Here's the problem that we have. You've got to have rational criteria on this thing. A lot of the elements of this bill are necessary, and they come up through the Congress from people who get represented. They represented the districts. So the general idea is, in order to judge which provisions should stay and which provisions should go, forget about deficits, first of all. We'll explain why deficits are not the main thing, any more than stock values would be. What you've got to do is have a rational criterion of what do you want to do and what do you not want to do. Let's start with what you don't want to do. That's the easiest. Not one penny for banks. Get that money back from Wall Street. Don't bail out any banks. Have a criterion of elementary class consciousness. Wall Street bankers, jackals, hyenas, raptors, and so forth, are not to be recipients of any public money whatsoever because they carry out no socially necessary or productive function. They don't lend to industry. They don't create plant and equipment. They are derivatives monsters. We don't need to subsidize such derivatives monsters. The other thing we don't need, of course, is money for Acorn. We don't need to finance the creation of a fascistoid internal security structure here. This is presumably getting to be something like Barkey's informal Green Corps or National Security Corps. No money for Acorn, no money for these so-called community development projects, which usually amount to the financing of race war or incendiary demagogues to pit different parts of the population against each other. In other words, no money for poverty pimps, no money for community organizers, no money for the kind of thing that Barkey has devoted his life to doing. No money for foundations and no money assisted by foundations. Rather, we ought to slap a very, very confiscatory tax on the existing foundations with the goal of shutting them down in many cases. That goes especially for the Ford, the Rockefeller, the Carnegie, the Gates, the Broad, the Annenberg, and the rest of them, right, whose stock in trade is to finance union busting and race war, helping to drive down the standard of living of the American people. So no money for banks, no money for Acorn, and no money for the gangrene economy. We'll get to the gangrene economy here in just a minute. Public Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpa here in Washington, D.C. Let me call your attention once again to my books on Obama, Against Obama, Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, and Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Both of these are available at Amazon.com, and they continue to sell very well in Germany, Japan. Italian edition is coming, and perhaps others also as we proceed. So get the lowdown on Barkey and get the background. Remember, biography in particular is destiny. There is no predestination. Nothing is written, but biography impels, although it does not compel. In the case of Barkey, we can basically see what he's up to based on his past experience, his life as a poverty pimp for the foundations, his operations as a divide-and-conquer operative of the ruling elite. The so-called watchdog agency, really a rather pathetic thing, but the so-called watchdog agency of the bailout, the TARP, installments 1 and 2, both of them organized by Barkey and Bush together in the United Front, says that $78 billion have been lost, stolen by the banks on the first round of the TARP. So that's $80 billion out of $350 billion. And remember, all of that went to banks, insurance companies, mutual funds, money markets, credit card companies, only financial institutions. You had to be a parasite to qualify for the $350 billion of the first round of the TARP. And now this charming lady comes forward and says, well, guess what? $80 billion of that has been lost. Maybe this puts it into perspective. This is why no money for Wall Street, not one penny for any bank, with almost no exceptions, certainly not the money center Wall Street banks. So the question now is, what do you not want? Well, you don't want money going to banks. You don't want money going to Acorn. And you don't want money going to the gangrene economy. The gangrene economy, of course, is this idea of green jobs. Green jobs are a fraud. The more green jobs you have, the poorer you are. Because the very essence of a green job is that you're not creating jobs at the most advanced attainable level of technology, which is what you need. It is the human condition. You've got to use the best technology you can get, not some backward technology, because some rich elitist oligarch from the Canoe Federation, the Wilderness Society, Greenpeace, the Friends of the Earth, the Sierra Club, and the rest of these characters has some ideological shtick that Rousseau was right and primitive society was better. So why don't we go back to the agricultural paradise, not even of Thomas Jefferson. Remember, Marie Antoinette at Versailles had this peasant village where she got dressed up as a shepherdess and pretended to be a peasant. And that was right before the revolution hit and the society fell apart. So forget green jobs. Forget the gangrene economy. An extraordinary development on this front in the past week. Sweden. Out of all the places in the world, you might say that Scandinavia is one of the places where the cultural pessimism, the historical pessimism, the fear of science, the fear of technology, the fear of industry, the fear of progress has been the thickest. Well, it looks like the Swedish government is preparing to go nuclear. And they're caught in some ways in their own ideology. They say, well, we don't want to produce greenhouse gases. I mean, this is a fraud, as we know on this program. We know that there is no anthropogenic global warming. Global warming is not caused by human activity. It is a feature of the sunspot cycle and generally of solar activity over long waves of several centuries, right? Going back to the Little Ice Age around 1600 to 1700, which was the minimum, the Spörer and Maunder minimum of the sunspot cycle, and then going back to the medieval warm period around 1100, which was a high point of sunspot activity and solar activity. So the Swedish government is now in the process of clearing the decks for a return to nuclear energy after about 30 years. And they're doing this also because their neighbors in Finland are busily building a nuclear reactor, the first one in Western Europe in quite a while. Now, what it means is the fraud engineered by Carter and Brzezinski at Three Mile Island, this stunt with the help of Jane Fonda and her movie, The China Syndrome, with poor Jack Lemmon joining in, the thick mantle of cultural pessimism and historical pessimism is being rent sometimes just by the pressure of the crisis. So Sweden goes nuclear. That really ought to convince people of something. We also have here a very interesting article. The Washington Examiner, a newspaper you can get for free in the subway, talks about the new chief of staff of the U.S. Treasury Department, Mark Patterson. He is a creature of Daschle. We know all about Daschle, right? Daschle, the senator from Citibank, Daschle with his lobbyist wife. But now we're talking Mark Patterson, chief of staff for Geithner at the Treasury Department. And this guy comes from Goldman Sachs. He was a Goldman Sachs in-house lobbyist. And what did he do? His specialty was issues related to the use of wind energy and renewable energy. Fuel economy mandates, renewable fuels, cellulosic ethanol, and above all, total support for carbon trading and carbon offsets. Cellulosic ethanol, anything to do with ethanol is genocide because it's driving up the price of corn so that people in the third world die. That's the story in Mexico. Mexico is in a tremendous social crisis, among other things, because of the price of the corn that is the staple in the national diet. So this character, Patterson, is an example of the gangrene economy, the gangrene entrepreneurs. And what they do, as the interesting article here by Timothy P. Carney, reactionary, but clear-eyed on this issue, in the Washington Examiner, is this is how the gangrene economy works. Now, this is what he writes now, and I quote, "A well-connected company invests in a technology that is currently unprofitable. That company then uses its high-dollar lobbyists and friends inside government to subsidize or mandate that product into profitability, to subsidize it. In other words, it's an economy, it's a technology which is not economical. It is not viable on its own. It requires a huge government subsidy. It makes society poorer to create these things. So Goldman Sachs invested in and lobbied for greenhouse gas credits, which are basically worthless, but they go together with this cap-and-trade stuff. So we've now got, under Barkey, a big assault of green, or in my terminology, gangrene corporate lobbying, investing in inefficient fuels or greenhouse gas credits can only make you money if you combine these with good lobbying. A good gangrene lobbyist is like an alchemist turning lead into gold. Mark Patterson, now a top official at Obama's Treasury Department working for Geithner, and Goldman Sachs have not turned, they've not figured out how to make switchgrass into energy, but they turned it into big money for themselves. So when you hear this stuff about green jobs, that's what it means. These are the boondoggles of our time. Boondoggle means paying extra money for a backward technology because some rich elitist thinks this is a good idea in terms of return to the Rousseau noble savage, something back in the Stone Age, be it Neolithic or Paleolithic even. And, of course, then finance oligarchs come in and figure ways to make money off of this. Barbara Boxer and her committee are now preparing a cap-and-trade system to create a speculative bubble in carbon. This must be blocked at all costs. No gangrene economy, please. Back in a minute. Radio, Webster Toffley in Washington, D.C. So when it comes to stimulus, when it comes to hopefully an economic recovery bill, you need that. Do you think the federal government ought to fight a world economic depression, or should the United States capitulate and surrender to a world economic depression created by cliques of pathological, socially unaccountable bankers? Well, fight it, of course. Fight the depression. Defeat the depression. Outflank it. Smash it. Turn it into a recovery. And in order to do that, you've got to say, first of all, not one penny for the finance oligarchs, not one penny for Wall Street, hedge funds, banks, and other parasitical operations, not one penny to bail out the derivatives bubble, not one penny for Acorn. We don't need a fascistoid social structure, kind of a return to the Office of Economic Opportunity poverty pimp operation, which was the predecessor to Barkey's world, and no money for the gangrene economy. All investments must be made at the most advanced level of technology. They've got to be high capital intensity, high energy intensity, high productivity. These all go together. High wage. Get the U.S. back on track to be a high wage economy with full employment. So the labor market is a seller's market. If you have to go in there and sell your labor, you're in the catbird seat and not some wage gouging, union busting sweatshop employer, which is the dream world of quite a few of the Republicans. So therefore, we have a criteria of what we do want. A good example of what you do want, this S-CHIP bill, the state child health insurance program. Yes, you want it. Don't you think children should have medical insurance? How are you going to compete in today's world if your children are diseased and sick and drained of energy by the fact that they've got easily preventable medical conditions? Are we nuts, people? Yes, you want it. S-CHIP. Long overdue. And don't worry whether that's competing with some private insurance company. The private insurance companies are all going bankrupt anyway. AIG is bankrupt. Who could say, how dare you interfere with the free market with S-CHIP and interfere with the fact that AIG stands ready to provide this insurance? Well, they're basically bankrupt. So if it weren't for the federal government, that insurance would be gone already, and it will be gone. So forget about bailing out AIG. Much better to put your money into the state child health insurance program and take it away from AIG. Much cheaper, infinitely cheaper. Notice also this morning, The Hartford, one of the larger Connecticut-based insurance companies. This is the complex that owns our dear friend Senator Lieberman. The Hartford stock took a 20% dive. If you got business insurance or some other kind of insurance with The Hartford, you want to take a look at that. Same thing goes for Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, MetLife, The Prudential, The Hartford, Connecticut General. All of these companies are insurance companies that have dabbled very heavily in the deadly toxic derivatives that are destroying the world. So you better have federal programs to provide this insurance, because the private ones are striking out. So therefore, you want money to go into Medicare. You want money to go into Medicaid. You want money to go into state budgets in particular. You want money to go into food stamps. You've got to pay up the levels of unemployment insurance in those state trust funds. You want to put money into infrastructure. Now, as far as I can see, the money for infrastructure in this bill is $40 billion. That's 1/20th or 1/25th of the entire bill. Multiply that by 5 or 10, and we'd begin to get somewhere. You want money to go into scientific research. You want money to go into medical research. You want money to go into the space program. Now, let's see what we have. The right-wing talk show hosts, led by Limbaugh, have launched an attack on the porculus. Okay, fine. Remember, pork. The goal of good government is pork. Pork is the essence of democratic politics in the sense of a free people. Pork means the task of government is to deliver the bacon. Government has to deliver a rising standard of living. The task of government is to generate and deliver increased levels of employment, a rising standard of living, and generally cultural and material improvements of life across the board. If that's not the purpose of government, what is the technical term eudaimonic legitimation? How can a government be legitimate if it's there to distribute sacrifices in the name of a clique of unaccountable and unelected bankers? No. Pork is the essence of government. Pork barrel legislation, the idea that there's something bad about this, is created by the bankers. The bankers don't want money to go to highways and roads or unemployment benefits or food stamps. They think that that's taken out of their hide. The bankers want the money to go to the bonded debt and to subsidies for bankers. They want it to go to corporate welfare, cuts in what they call business taxes, cuts in what they call the death tax, so they can keep their ill-gotten gains from one generation to another and let it take on a life of their own. You get the picture. The whole purpose of government under dirigism, protectionism, mercantilism, cameralism, in other words, the American system, is that the principal purpose of government is to increase the standard of living and deliver economic progress. So, so much for this porculous stuff. This was all done by Peter Peterson, this Wall Street ideologue. You've got the Peter Peterson Institute of International Economics over here now on Massachusetts Avenue across from Brookings here in Washington. You've got, you know, the Rudman, Senator Rudman of New Hampshire. These were the ideologues for the legions of greed, who are the exterminating angels of austerity. And we'll see that their main target is entitlement reform. They want to gouge your Social Security and gouge your Medicare. But before we get to that, let's just look at the fate now of this so-called stimulus package. What happened in the course of the last week is a concentrated attack by the reactionary radio talk show host led by Limbaugh, which is welcome in the sense that they're fighting Obama. But when it comes to economics, these people live on the far side of the moon. These are pre-Herbert Hoover ideas. These are basically Andrew Mellon ideas. They're actually the ideas of David Ricardo from the board of the British East India Company back in 1810 or 1815. This is the kind of stuff that Dickens was making fun of in A Christmas Carol. This is your all there no prisons, all there no workhouses. That's the kind of economics we're getting out of the radio talk show hosts, right? They say, oh, you think that people have economic rights? How dare you? You want to deliver health care to children? How dare you? That violates the free market. So that is the atmosphere. And then in the middle of this, a group of the most treacherous snakes of all, the liberal Republicans, led by these two harpies from Maine, Collins and the other one. You know the ones I mean. The two liberal Republicans from Maine have attempted to revive the so-called Gang of 14, left over from 2005. Ah, yes, the Gang of 14, when it came along, that was supposed to be the solution to the human condition, according to some misguided and in bad faith ideologues. And the original Gang of 14 brought us who? Alito and Roberts. Not so great. So now we've got something that looks like this Gang of 14 back again with Collins and the other one. And what they want to do is to increase the tax cuts, which is fine in itself. But here's what they want to take out. This is the big problem. Look what they want to take out. $40 billion for state education departments to shore up school budgets. This means schools, teachers, elementary essential part of civilization. These liberal austerity ideologues, these Malthusian Gang of 14, want to take that out of the stimulus bill. No, you need that $40 billion. That's minimal for school budgets. How about this? $14 billion for education programs, including special education and Head Start. This $14 billion is minimal. We want it. We want it multiplied by 5 to 10. So you see the tendency. Back in a minute. This is Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. Once again, get your copies of Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, and Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, both available at Amazon.com. Continuing on this question of the stimulus bill, the emergence of Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins of Maine, two treacherous liberal Republicans, Wall Street Republicans, Rockefeller Republicans, if you will, has crystallized the question of what ought to go into this bill and what not. Please don't stand on the sidelines of history saying free market, there shouldn't be any stimulus bill. This is absurd. Should the federal government fight a world economic depression, or should it surrender to a world economic depression, an enemy on the Hitlerian scale? Well, as soon as you've asked that, anybody with any brains would say, no, the depression has got to be fought. There is no yin and yang cycle. The trade cycle is a fiction. It's made up to cover nefarious activities by financiers. So once you've agreed that the federal government needs to fight the depression, the question is, how do you do that? And we've been saying, no money for banks, not one penny for derivatives, no money for Acorn. You don't need a fascistoid social structure to enforce some kind of totalitarian rule on the home front. No gangrene economy, nothing that's predicated on global warming, Malthusianism, the limits to growth, the desirability of windmills, the inherent superiority of backward technology. Right? Let's go back to the horse and buggy. Let's go back to the horse-drawn plow. Oh, my God, spare me. And then the question is, well, let's look at these cuts that the Snow and Collins liberal Republican Wall Street combine are imposing. The reason they're important is because the Democrats, I believe, are at 58 to 59 votes, and this is what you need. Those two swing votes from Maine become very important. So under the leadership of these two harpies, they want to cut $40 billion from state education departments. This is a terrible mistake. They want to cut $14 billion for education programs, including special education for disabled children, and Head Start. Now, at Head Start, we've really got to fight. Head Start is absolutely essential. Head Start is a preschool program where the little children, toddlers in this case, get a good breakfast, sometimes the best meal they get any time in the day, and then they get preschool training that gets them up to speed in terms of reading and writing and the essentials so that they can enter school successfully. What do you want to do? Do you want to consign a whole generation of poor kids to the human junk heap? If these reactionaries are opposing S-CHIP and they're opposing Head Start, what's going to happen to these people who are growing up in poverty and they're in increasing numbers? So all of those programs have to be increased, not cut. The liberal combine, the Gang of 14 or whatever it is, the Collins Snow cabal and their followers also want to cut $10 billion from the Department of Energy, including an environmental cleanup fund. Well, you do need an environmental cleanup fund if you have toxic waste sites. That's a matter of human consideration, right? That's not being done for some mythical polar bear or whale or snail darter. This is that you can't live successfully, you know, by the Love Canal, where all of this toxic waste is lying around. And then, maybe the most dramatic, the liberal cabal wants to cut $6.5 billion for space exploration, science programs, and grants for local crime-fighting efforts. Now, the crime-fighting, I don't know who's for it, but let's forget about that one for the moment. The really clear one, space exploration and science programs. Now, you don't get out of a depression without science drivers. I've indicated three. The obvious science drivers right now at the beginning of the 21st century are the exploration and permanent colonization and industrial production on the moon, Mars, and nearby objects in the solar system. That is absolutely essential. It's got to be done by government. The private sector will never do it. They have struck out. They have failed. They send tourists into space for $50 million, but not a factory on the moon or a factory on Mars, which is the direction you've got to go in. Your second point is high-energy physics. You've got to make thermonuclear fusion power viable and then go beyond it, antimatter, and so forth. And the third one, biomedical. Anything that has to do with biomedical is sacrosanct because this touches human life. So the liberal cabal, the Wall Street cabal, is riding herd on the stimulus bill coming out of Congress, right? Because you think it's Barkey, but it's actually a lot of this is coming from people in the House and the Senate who represent districts, especially in the House. They want to cut $6.5 billion out of NASA, out of space exploration and science programs. That money should be multiplied by a factor of 10. Now, isn't it interesting? If you add up $40 billion for the state education departments, $14 billion for Head Start, $10 billion for the Department of Energy and $6.5 billion for NASA, that's approximately $75 to $80 billion, and that's equal to what the banks have stolen out of the first round of the TARP. Get the picture? Wall Street is getting the lion's share and the programs that are absolutely essential for the survival of the American people and their economic viability are getting the axe. and the crumbs are being left for the hoi polloi. This is the problem, not that the stimulus is wrong or that the government should capitulate and surrender to the depression. No, what's wrong is that the money is not being used in the proper manner. All of these points, in particular, that space exploration one and the Head Start one, to pick a right-wing one and a left-wing one, just to show you, those are the ones where more money ought to be spent. Now, what Barkey, of course, is doing is attempting to get left cover. And what does he actually plan to do? Let's take a look. There are two things that are coming up, and we'll devote the rest of the program to these. We're going to probably have Phil Berg on in the next segment to give a report on the legal fight against the Obama usurper regime, the tenant of the White House. But there are two things going on now. One is the grand bargain. One is the late February to early March monster vampire confab for the purpose of looting entitlements. The grand bargain, which will be marked by cutting social programs and increasing taxes across the board, and that will be marked by the looting of the entitlement programs, taking away your economic rights. That's the grand bargain, the fiscal responsibility summit. Barkey has promised a fiscal responsibility summit in early March, and that is going to be, among other things, the question of tackling all the long-standing problems that the oligarchs have been screaming about. Peter Peterson and the rest of these people have been screaming about health care costs, escalating health care costs, a Byzantine tax code, entitlement reform, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the tax code, a reform plan. And they want to do this on a fast track. They want to do it in the form that once you have a task force of oligarchs and Malthusians and gougers, that the recommendations of the task force could not be amended. The House and Senate would be required to accept or reject them without changes or additions, similar to procedures used by lawmakers on military base closures. Now, the article here, you ought to take a look at it. This is Washington Post, Monday, February 2nd, Democrats set high goal of sweeping fiscal reform as Senate open stimulus debates, sacrifices become more urgent. So the idea is, if you've already given $700 billion to Wall Street and they're gearing up to give another trillion at least to Wall Street, that's got to come out of your hide. That's going to come out of your Social Security, your Medicaid, your Medicare, and other provisions, including tax increases, including under the cover of carbon and polar bears and the rest of this stuff. So this is it. This is how Barkey is coming after you. Get ready to fight for your economic rights. Back in a minute. In Washington, D.C. So watch out. The grand bargain, the fiscal responsibility summit under the watchword of sacrifice, will be convened at the end of February during March. And the goal to do what Bush could not do, to loot Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, to loot you more through the tax code and every other way they can. John Ensign, Republican of Nevada, says you're talking about a middle-class tax increase to pay for this. This meaning the bailout of Wall Street under the $700 billion in the TARP and the $1 trillion now being planned for the bad bank, which is the project being worked on by the diabolical, demonized Geithner at the Treasury. But now, in the meantime, let's look in on the legal front, the opposition against the usurper, against the tenant of the White House on the basis of his constitutional non-qualification. So we're glad once again to welcome our good friend, Philip J. Berg of Philadelphia. Welcome, Phil.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi there, Phil.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we're delighted to have you with us again. Thank you so much for making time. And maybe you just give us a concise summary of what's going on the legal front in the fight to expose the non-qualification of Barry Sotero to be in the White House.
Sure. Well, first off, everyone has to understand that they should go to our website. We're not completely updated. I want to get updated more often, but we're doing a lot. ObamaCrimes.com. We'll give you the most updated information on where we are and what we're doing. We have three lawsuits pending at the present time, and we're going to continue our efforts. We're about to have a fourth one filed. We're staying very focused. We are going to expose the truth about Obama, that he's not natural born, he's not qualified to be president, and then once the truth comes out, we'll have to figure out what steps we have to take to have him removed from office. Because he doesn't belong there, and it's a disgrace. We have three actions pending at the present time. One action is pending. That's in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. That's our original case, which we had filed against Obama, which we had bypassed the Third Circuit and hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court would do something. Unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court did not do anything, so we had to... they toss us out, but we're still in the Third Circuit. We filed our brief back on January 20th. So the case is alive and well. This is the case that was dismissed in the district court. We're arguing standing is the first issue, and standing has to get resolved because it's outrageous that I wouldn't have standing. The court said that I didn't have standing, you didn't have standing, no one had standing, which is absolutely absurd. So we're going to continue on those efforts in that case. The other case we have is the case of the retired Air Force Colonel, Colonel Hollister. In that case, the opposition, which is Obama and Biden, have filed a motion to dismiss. We're working on our response, which is due Monday or Tuesday. We could file an answer to the motion to dismiss. Instead, we're going to be filing an amended complaint, which is proper under the rules.
Phil, so, I guess we should be glad that they're even responding at all, huh? They respond with a motion to dismiss. That's already something.
Sure. Well, that's their position. They're just trying to avoid the whole topic. One of these days, we'll be able to get one judge, you know, pass one judge so we can make them start to respond to the actual lawsuit, which is pending. But that's the case where Colonel Hollister is on the ready reserve. And his lawsuit is basically, if Obama calls him back to active duty, does he reject the order based upon the fact that he does not have the authority to issue the order because he's an unqualified president, or does he follow the order because Obama is a legitimate president, which we know he is not? So that's the second case. The third case, which I really believe is probably the most significant case, and that's the case where it's under seal, so I can't discuss the case. And hopefully, I just filed in that case a motion to unseal the case and allow us to proceed. So we're waiting for a ruling on the court on that. The fourth case, which will be filed, is the issue of quo warranto, which you file when someone's in office and they have no right to be in office. But we're dedicated to go forth as long as we can withhold the time periods and the costs involved. That's why we ask people to go to our website, to spread our website to everyone they know in their address book. We need more and more people to be aware of what's going on. At the present time, we think maybe 5, 10, 15 million people know, which is a lot of people, but there's 220 million people over the age of 18. Remember, Obama got 69 million votes, but that means that he did not get 150 million votes. You know, even though McCain got 59 million or 60 million, 60 instead of 130, 90 million people who were eligible to vote did not vote. So there's a lot of people out there that we have to get the message to. And I think once the majority of people know what's going on, that we will be successful, because I think people will be appalled at this. This is supposed to be, the Obama presidency is supposed to be so transparent. Well, if the president can't even acknowledge his background, how is it transparent? So that's where we are right now, and we're proceeding full steam ahead.
So, you know, that Barkey, Obama went to this retreat by the Democratic congressional people in Williamsburg, Virginia. They have it every year around now. And he seemed to have a temper tantrum. This is where he started saying that if we have a crisis now, we're going to have a catastrophe. We don't want to have a catastrophe. And I won the election, and we want to get rid of these old ideas and so forth. A lot of people are looking at this temper tantrum as the first sign of a kind of psychological disintegration of Obama. Remember, he's never had an executive job. He's never had to deal with a legislature that was independent of him that could defy him. His polls are falling. There was one report that from the first week to the third week, he was down 15% or so in the polls, and he seems to have a need of adulation. I'm also wondering whether this gnawing sense that your case is correct and that the charges that you're making are absolutely justified is getting to him. After all, why doesn't he come forward with his birth certificate? At least that much would help to quell the criticism, at least for some.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the reason he doesn't, because he doesn't have it. He has a birth certificate, I'm sure, from Kenya. And we were thinking why the certification of my birth that he put forth was not even his, because they phonied up the one from his half-sister, Maya. And we believe because he was adopted, all his records were probably sealed.
Hang on 1 second, Phil. We'll be back in just a minute.
For listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Crisis Radio, Webster Topley in Washington, D.C. We're talking to Phil Berg in Philadelphia. Phil, of course, the leading protagonist in the legal struggle to force Obama to either produce his birth certificate and evidence of U.S. citizenship or to depart from the White House, which he is now usurping. I just want to remind everybody, you might still be able to get your collector's copy of The Globe. The Globe, dated February 2nd, 2009, the well-known supermarket tabloid. The Globe, 8 shocking secrets will wreck the new president. What Obama is hiding from America. Out of those 8 points, they give 2 to Phil, and really should have given him 3 or 4 in terms of the work that he's been doing since August. So, Phil, why don't you just give the website one more time, and we'll let you go.
Sure. It's ObamaCrimes.com. OBAMACRIMES.com, one word. Please, everyone, go there. Most important is spread it to everyone you know. The more people who become aware of the situation, the more we'll get to the truth. The second thing, if you can afford, please make a contribution to us. And I will continue to be on your show, Webster, to give you weekly updates. And we are determined we're going to stay with this to make this transparent presidency transparent to expose what he really is.
And I think, Phil, you already see this evidence, right? The loss of 15 points of popularity in about 2 weeks, according to one poll, indicates the tremendous potentiality of Obama to crater in the polls. That is, once people realize what he's doing, his unpopularity will skyrocket, and a lot of people will be looking around for some way to contain him, and indeed to get rid of him. And I think that's when these cases will come into their own. So let me urge everybody, go to that website, ObamaCrimes.com. Make a contribution. Phil, I think you're a little bit pessimistic on the 15 to 20 million. I think it's significantly higher. It's some multiple of that. But time will tell. So thanks to Phil Berg, and we'll see you next week.
Very good. My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Phil. So there's the question. And again, I have come to the unfortunate conclusion based on the legal arguments of Counselor Berg that we're dealing again with a usurper in the White House. In other words, as he says, this is an illegitimate president, not a president, but a tenant of the White House, unfortunately, in the same way that Bush was, because of his stealing the election in 2004 with this clique of Kabbalists there in the Supreme Court, and then again the Ohio vote fraud with Diebold machines in 2004. So let's just return for a moment to the economic front. What we're going to get, therefore, is the grand bargain. This was a column by George Will the Shill. But then this more detailed story, Monday, February 2nd, Washington Post, Democrats set high goal of sweeping fiscal reform by Lori Montgomery. And this is the idea of dealing with a long-term structural deficit, which has been made worse by things like the $700 billion given to the Wall Street hyenas under the TARP, the bailout round one and bailout round two. And we know already that $80 billion, even according to their own so-called toothless watchdog report, has been essentially stolen, which would finance this wonderful list of things that you really do need to get out of a depression. Let me also point out, deficits mean very little at this point. I've stressed again and again, don't worry about the price of paper either way. Forget paper. Forget the price of stocks. Forget the price of bonds. That's all gone. It's all water over the bridge. Forget it, under the bridge, over the dam. The question right now is, you're inside a collapsing bubble. You cannot do anything to stop the collapse of asset values. We've had a multi-decade asset bubble. It's now coming down. No force in the universe can stop it. There is no way to bail out 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives. You just have to write them off. There's no way to save the banks, in particular J.P. Morgan Chase, the leading derivatives monster. You can't save them. You can't save these insurance companies. They're up to their necks in derivatives. So forget the price of paper. And the question of deficits is very, very marginal at this point. You're in a crashing bubble. The question you have to ask yourself is not what the price of paper will be or where the Dow Jones will be in 1 or 2 years. The question is, how many people will have died? Can you keep your citizenry alive? That's number one. Then you get into these questions. What's your industrial production when you come out of this? The things that you need to preserve human life and human civilization. What's your energy production? What's your food production? What's your steel production? What's your chemical production? What's your infrastructure production? What's your capability to build some great projects? The only way to get out of a depression is through these great projects. And let me stress again, even the London Financial Times asked, where is the TVA? Where is the regional program of, in this case, hydroelectric and water projects? Where is the moonshot? Where is the NASA in this bill? And where's the supersonic transport? I would say today the scramjet, the Orient Express, a new generation of air travel beyond the Concorde, right? Concorde for the masses, but a generation beyond that. You don't get out of a depression without science drivers and without the huge projects of infrastructure that actually change people's lives. So don't worry about the deficit. Those dollars are largely going to be destroyed by hyperinflation. We're now into hyperinflation. The bubble is coming down. The $700 billion has been let out. $8 trillion total bailout money for banks, 0% interest rates. Everybody in the world stimulating. Europe, $3 to $4 trillion thrown in the form of injections. So all of that adds up to a growing momentum in the direction of hyperinflation. So don't worry so much about these deficits. The main question is, will your people be alive? Will your industrial production be intact? Will your agricultural production be intact? If you have all that, you can survive. So that's why in this interim time, use this money system to mobilize resources. In other words, to put unemployed workers together with idle factories and produce things that you need for human life. And the payment side of it, the paper side of it, is of tertiary importance. Money is the way we have to mobilize the economy. So move the money around in such a way as to mobilize the economy. But don't waste any more money on the banking sector. And that's, of course, what's being prepared. Geithner, the demon at the Treasury with his gangrene chief of staff over there, Geithner is preparing the bad bank. This is the thing to really watch out for. This will now be a second round of bailout beyond the TARP, beyond the October to December bailout. This will now be a derivatives receptacle. The U.S. government is going to buy toxic paper and put it into a bad bank. And I would guess that they'll demand $1 trillion for this. That's the one to fight. Don't waste your time fighting S-CHIP so that poor children get medical care. That's grotesque. Save your money to fight the bankers. And again, the principal maxim of strategy in this time is fight finance oligarchs, fight financiers, fight bankers, fight derivatives merchants, fight derivatives monsters. If you're not fighting financiers, you're wasting your time and spinning your wheels. And that, I think, is the question. Now, let's just look at a historical look backward. This is not out of the blue, but out of an article here in the Washington Post on Sunday, February 1st. We've got an awful woman coming forward. Her name is Amity Schles. Amity, she's very badly named. S-H-L-A-E-S. And this is now the modern pygmies attacking the lion, Franklin D. Roosevelt. It's called The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Depression. Back in a minute.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
Back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. Before we get to Amity Schles, one last thing. The Economic Recovery Advisory Board of the Obama regime, ERAB, Economic Recovery Advisory Board. The ERABs are coming, and they're led by Paul Adolf Volcker, as we know, Trilateral Commission, former head of the Federal Reserve, 22% prime rate. That means 30 to 35% for the rest of us who don't get the prime rate. Destroyed the U.S. industrial base, engineered the Great U-Turn, helped to transform the U.S. economy from a high-wage progressive economy to a low-wage sweatshop economy. Also responsible for wiping out the usury laws in many states because of his lunatic, monetarist, high-interest rate policy. Volcker is the chairman. Who else is on the Economic Recovery Advisory Board, now ensconced in the Barkey White House? William Donaldson of the Securities and Exchange Commission, ex, a stock jobber, a monetarist. Roger Ferguson of TIAA CREF, a derivatives merchant. Martin Feldstein, a veteran, discredited wheelhorse, economic hack, and economic ideologue of Harvard, a monetarist, Martin Feldstein. Penny Pritzker from Barkey's Finance Committee, expert in super exploitation of minority cleaning ladies in her hotel chain. Penny Pritzker, also on the ERAB. Jim Owens of Caterpillar. This is the only industrial company apparently on the list. So, well, that's one. Caterpillar, there's a company that ought to be increasing their production to 5 million tractors a year. and sell them all around the world in terms of a world economic recovery. I wonder if that's what Jim Owens has in mind. Then we have Comrade Immelt of General Electric. Now, General Electric looks like an industrial company, but don't be fooled. The heart of this is now GE Capital, a hedge fund in drag. So Immelt is actually a finance capitalist masquerading as an industrial capitalist on this board. And these are not the same, dear listeners. We've also got Anna Berger, the Queen of Labor. Now, she is a creature of Andy Stern of the Service Employees International Union. Remember, this is now the model of low-wage unionism. Not join a union so you can have decent wages and benefits, but join the union so you can pay Andy Stern and be a battering ram for him. Anna Berger is the she's an official of Change to Win. Now, Change to Win, remember, when Andy Stern, obviously following the dictates of the ruling class, split the AFL-CIO in 2005, Anna Berger became a top official of this Change to Win. So she will be on this committee. And Trumka of the AFL-CIO. Now, the last I heard of Trumka was back in the 1990s. He was working for the United Mine Workers, and he was under threat of being indicted. So they were basically blackmailing him. The federal prosecutors and the FBI were blackmailing Trumka, saying, if you don't do what we tell you, we'll put you away. Very, very common. Notice also this past week, Barkey and Michelle left the White House to visit a school in the District of Columbia. Was it a public school? No. It was a charter school. Now, this is going to be Arne Duncan and that union-busting agenda against the American Federation of Teachers, which we've talked about as time goes on. But now let's get back to this interesting book from Amity Schles, S-H-L-A-E-S. Who is Amity Schles? Remember, the Wall Street Journal had a multi-part series, Who is Vince Foster? They haven't done one, Who is Barkey Obama? But who is Amity Schles? Well, she's from the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations is attacking the heritage of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Does this cause some cognitive dissonance? Will this shock some of our Austrians into awareness of what's actually going on and how they're being duped? I certainly hope so. The Austrian line, of course, is that Franklin D. Roosevelt was the dawning of Wall Street. This is absolutely fantastic, radically anti-historical, lunatic thesis. And here now we have a member of the Council of Foreign Relations in New York, the Bankers Boys Anonymous, who is attacking Roosevelt. This should teach you something. Her husband is a guy who worked for quite a number of years on the New York Sun, the neocon rag that just went bankrupt and closed in November of last year. Amity Schles, when Phil Graham, the ogre who ran the economic policy division of McCain and helped to doom McCain with his advice that the economy was sound, you remember that one in September. Phil Graham, remember, had this very, very offensive tirade where he said Americans are a bunch of whiners. They're whining about the economy, and gosh, we don't even have a recession yet. Well, with exquisite pedantry and ruling class arrogance and contempt, Amity Schles came out saying, oh, Phil Graham is right. The academic definition of a recession is two quarters where the gross domestic product goes down. So this is the woman they trot out to attack Roosevelt. Now, you got to know some things. During the 1930s, large parts of the U.S. ruling class were pro-fascist and pro-Hitler. There's not a word about that in here. The main event of the World Economic Depression was not the October 1929 crash of the New York stock market, but rather the bankruptcy and default on gold payment of the British pound, September 1931. Now, you hear the Limbaughs, the reactionaries, and these guys, when it comes to economics, again, they are off the deep end. They are in la-la land. They're stark raving mad. They all repeat, the New Deal prolonged the Depression. The New Deal, Roosevelt, prolonged the Depression. Well, wait a minute. What does that mean? How can you tell that? So here's Amity Schles. She says, the problem with the New Deal was that investors, U.S. investors and even foreign investors, never got a sense that the United States was now open for business. Now, remember, most of these so-called investors are fascists and Nazis at this point, be they on the U.S. side or some other side. So she says, as a result, the Depression lasted half a decade longer than it had to, from 1929 to 1940, rather than, say, 1929 to 1936. The Dow Jones Industrial Average did not return to its summer 1929 high until 1954. The monetary shock was immense, but it was this duration that made the Depression the Great Depression. Now, wait a minute. There's so many mistakes in here. We've got to go through them one by one. How does she know that the Depression would have ended? The theory there is the old Herbert Hoover line, prosperity is just around the corner, and that's what you hear from Limbaugh every day. Prosperity is just around the corner. They shimmer back and forth, the Limbaughs, the Hannitys, and so forth. Sometimes they say, there is no Depression. It's not that bad. It's been worse. It was worse under Carter, and so forth. There is no Depression. The other side is, well, there may be a Depression, but it will be over soon, and it will be over automatically because prosperity is just around the corner. Well, Herbert Hoover kept saying that. 1930, prosperity is just around the corner. Economy deteriorates. 1931, Herbert Hoover, prosperity is just around the corner. Economy is still crashing. 1932, prosperity is still just around the corner, but things getting worse, worse, worse. 1933, until the very last day, Herbert Hoover was promising prosperity just around the corner. Also remember that Herbert Hoover's acceptance speech for the 1932 Republican nomination, rugged individualism. Let's have rugged individualism in the face of a world economic depression. Absolutely fantastic, lunatic, reactionary thesis. The problem with these people is the monetarists, the Austrians, the students of the Austrian business cycle theory, think that there's an automatic recovery. That's not even Herbert Hoover. That's even worse than Herbert Hoover. That's Andrew Mellon. Remember what he says. Liquidate stocks, liquidate bonds, liquidate labor, liquidate real estate, liquidate everything, then you'll get a recovery. This is the Schumpeter creative destruction madness. Well, if you're on the receiving end of creative destruction, if you get liquidated, you're not going to be too happy. How many people have to die in that process? Lots, based on the current trends, right? If California really has stopped sending out welfare checks on February 1st, which we're still trying to figure out, and if the state unemployment budgets are exhausted, then the morbidity mortality rates go through the ceiling. So this is a big lie. There is no automatic recovery from a depression. You get out of a depression by fighting a depression. That's the lesson of the 1930s. Herbert Hoover kept promising that there would be an automatic recovery. There is no automatic recovery. You've got to make it happen, and government is the key tool for doing it. So take over the government and fight the depression, and we'll be back next week on World Crisis Radio.